welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. That debt is fraud. We need to continue this paradigm of Learn, Pray, Act, and we need to focus on demanding full compliance to the Constitution. As a matter of fact, we need to start going out of our way in pointing to all of these myopic organizations, whether it be, you know, health freedom, whether it be Second Amendment. We need to start calling them out and saying, you're trying to get us to focus on just one clause of the Constitution or one problem with government, and you're getting us to turn our back on all the other problems and the rest of the Constitution. And so in doing that, folks, we can help everybody start seeing how these organizations are actually the distraction. They're not getting us to unite. Right? I mean, if we're going to win and vanquish our foe, we have to be united. And as a matter of fact, I'll dive into this as well. Because I tell you, it is paramount that we take back the party, that the Republican Party become the Constitutional Party. Because the Constitutional Party, hate to say this, they don't care about actually getting on top of the mountain and actually leading on the Constitution. There's so many different ways they could do this. But they are more focused on their history and their position on, you know, the moral positions that they've taken versus getting to the top of the mountain regarding the entire Constitution, banning full compliance, and so forth. So that being said, the only way, because the parties are the problem, and welcome back, Sean. And so I say this because almost every state party is plagued with sub-factions. And when we talk about sub-factions, we're talking about those factions that are demographic in nature, right? I mean, and we look at almost every state, you're going to find an organization of the Women's Republicans, right? Is that not a demographic faction of the Republicans?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What about the Young Republicans? In other words, those who are under a certain age. Is that not a demographic faction of the Republicans? And when we start looking at them, I know that was a rhetorical question, actually, because you don't have to say yes, sir. As a matter of fact, you don't have to say yes, sir. Yes is just fine. I never want to lecture anybody on respect, nor, you know, is there ever such a thing as wasted respect. But in the interest of time, you don't have to say sir. Please.
That's a tough one.
Okay, that's fine. I get
you
that.
You know, that Southern upbringing.
Yes, the culture, the refinement.
Absolutely.
I get that. So, and thank you.
I don't know about refinement, but they have manners.
Well, so it is a civil refinement. I mean, when we look at the history and we look at how these men, you know, spoke to each other in the ratification debates, you'll actually see how they say the fine gentleman, who's their opposition, who's lying through his teeth, but they still have this colloquial, you know, Gentile approach in fighting. And this was because in those days, you impugn somebody's character, you could be challenged to a duel. As a matter of fact, I forget the guy's name. It starts with a C. It wasn't Clay because he was a Federalist. But he was a young man. He was very young. And this was like his first cutting of his teeth in politics in Virginia. And he insulted Henry, Patrick Henry. And it was the way it was described in, you know, the editorial that I was reading. Because, you know, unfortunately, our history has become editorials where people kind of just, you know, paraphrase what happened. And, like, that's good enough. This is why I say no, no, no. We need to read the documents. But then you kind of lose the bigger picture. But I'm trying to point out that in the ratification debates, Colbert, something like that was the guy's name, and he insulted Patrick Henry. And Patrick Henry everybody looked at him like he was going to challenge this guy to a duel because, you know, Patrick Henry was pretty good with the sidearm. Anyway, instead, Patrick Henry just insulted him right back and then, you know, made this huge dramatic bowing. It was a very sarcastic insult back to this guy, like this guy was, you know, he was treating him like the king and elevated above all of us because of the wisdom that this young body possessed. And so when he was done, he kind of bowed in this really dramatic way of throwing his arms and coat out kind of thing. And at least that's how I remember this person paraphrasing it. And kind of everybody was at first aghast, and then they kind of laughed. And at that point, I think Colbert realized that he was just made fun of instead of being excoriated. So anyway, so we're talking about the government's responsibility regarding the militia. And to be clear, we kind of highlighted the importance of the states, because it says right here that the states will have the authority of training the militia according to the discipline described by or prescribed by Congress. When you read the Dick Act, the Dick Act takes all of this language and says that's not applicable. Now, near as I can tell, there is no act in the world that Congress can pass to apply that to the states, especially if it is contradictory and flies in the face of and violates the Constitution. The only way Congress can actually assume those powers in that Dick Act is via there's a process in the Constitution that they have to follow to actually be able to assume that power. And that power or that process is the amendment process, the Article 5 process. This has been stipulated, this has been clarified, and this is one of the reasons why it just, you know, the states in 1903 had been basically, they became the monkeys on the string for the organ grinder. They don't have, so here's the beautiful thing, folks. Everybody sees the monkeys on the string, you know, and the organ grinder, they're just dancing away. The monkeys still have the cognitive and the physical powers and abilities to remove that string, turn it around, and tie up their organ grinder. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so this is one of the reasons why I kind of pointed out in Madison's veto statement that regardless of whether the states decide to go along, it is always going to be an infraction. And at any point in time, the states can wake up and take their authority back and say, you can't do this anymore. And as a matter of fact, when you kind of look at how this grows, it creates these onions. And these onions, as you peel them back, you're going to find that there have been culprits that have created things that need to be called out, need to be held accountable. Some of them are alive and some of them are dead. Now, I work with people all the time that demand the full force of justice be levied upon all these people. And I think in my head, does that mean we need to go to a point where we start digging these people up and burning them in effigy? Is that what it's going to take to make people happy that we're finally getting things right? Because I will tell you, Frederick Douglass, and I think most all of the slaves that were still captivated until the Civil War, when they were finally freed, I think they were pretty happy when they were finally freed. Now, they've become the useful idiots because they don't understand the fact that our Constitution protects them from ex post facto laws, just like it protects everyone. It protects everybody equally. They never learned that the Jim Crow laws were literally unconstitutional. You cannot create a law and abridge. Now, if you look up the word abridge by definition, I mean, the Merriam-Webster definition probably sums this, the abridgment or an abridge, what that word means is to diminish in any way. And so I was presuming that you were probably looking it up. That's okay.
You know I do.
Yeah.
You make usually shorter do. In duration to lessen, diminish, to curtail.
Right. So in other words, I just use the word diminish to lessen. But when you look at the rights of the people, if there is a restaurant that is operating in business and you want to walk in and have a seat in that restaurant, it's open to the public. But they have a rule that says because the color of your skin, or because this, your skin, not your sin, the color of your skin or the gender or your age, you know, you're only 21, you're not old enough, or anything like that. If it's open to the public, you cannot be discriminated because it says right there in the 14th Amendment, no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. Those persons, being U.S. citizens, cannot have their right to sit anywhere that they want to in a on a public transportation or in a public restaurant and so forth. If a restaurant wants to have separate accommodations for people, then they need to be a club and not open to the public. Does that make sense? Because if you're a club, you can kind of treat your members because, hey, you know, why would you join a club if you're going to have to sit in the back next to the kitchen? Or, you know, why would you join a busing system in your city and become a member of a busing system if they're going to force you to sit in the back of the bus? Right? If they're going to oppress you or give you disadvantages, who would want to be a member of that club or that group? And when we look at public, that means society. So when the Jim Crow laws actually started creating this concept of separate but equal, this is when the judges did their job in taking something that protected everybody and redefined it to say, well, we can discriminate against these people. And as long as it's separate but equal. And, you know, the fact is, folks, the courts have no authority to create law, nor do the courts have the ability to redefine the Constitution. Now, when we look at the Dick Act, and I think there was some subsequent acts behind that, the Dick Act actually took away the state's ability and the county's ability to manage their militia and to maintain quotas and to actually have the militia structure. So what the federal government did is said, no, we're going to just give you, you know, the state a quota, and we'll manage that through, you know, those people, because they weren't going through the counties to get their people. And as a matter of fact, this is how the majority of the militia was the membership going into the National Guard started actually being around the population centers, because they just ignored the counties. Well, I mean, that's where we need them anyway. That's where the bulk of the people are. That's where the bases will be, what have you. And so when we look at, those who joined the military, you may have a lot of guys that actually joined the military from the very rural areas, but it's supposed to be managed county by county throughout the state. The states are supposed to do that. That's why this literally maintained the training and, you know, the management or the governing within the state to the states. So this becomes this huge backhand that the government did in actually taking away this system. And unfortunately, 100 years before this, or almost 100 years before this, the states actually stopped utilizing the militia in its own law enforcement and its own system itself. Because, you know, they didn't need to have, because having somebody, you know, with a sheriff with lots of deputies when you're not committing crimes, everybody looks at that and goes, well, those guys are making a decent pay and they're new and they're doing nothing. And the jealousy of those who have the job that just sitting around for the, you know, for when an emergency happens, well, it's nice to have them in that emergency, but every day that there's no emergency, people look at them with the, you know, the judgmental eye to say, we don't need those people just sitting there. But when you look at the militia structure should have been voluntary and or managed to be able to pull people in when needed immediately. If we were operating properly in our law enforcement and so forth, it would have been able to keep up with the demands or the no demands, if that makes sense. But making sure that everybody in the county, because let's just say, hey, we need Bob and Tim and Jim, you know, to get active in the militia. Oh, well, those guys are gone. Their work has taken them out of the county and out of state. Oh, okay, well, we don't have anybody else. No, everybody else is available. You just have quotas to put in your county, especially if everybody is trained. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
And so as we look at the militia system and the law requires every U.S. citizen to defend and support the Constitution and will take up arms if required by law, which means that when we need to suppress an insurrection, when we need to repel an invasion or execute the laws of the Union, your county or your state will literally issue a law and say, we need to activate this many people. The sheriff will say, I'm looking at this, I'm going to need this many people. And they usually pad it, on the high side because, there's advantages to having numbers, right? There's safety in numbers. So bottom line, those numbers should be easily obtainable from the county, and if not, neighboring counties, and if not, from the state. The fact is, that was the brilliant system that we had. We never developed it because everybody thought that and those people who were leading realized that if they didn't utilize and develop the system where we could actually, self-police ourselves and, kind of maintain this great, experiment of self-government. And instead, they started controlling and managing us. And they started creating mercenary police forces in the cities and in the counties. The county sheriff is now a police force or an enforcement agency instead of being a part of the militia and depending upon the people. Anyway, we're diving through this. I don't think I think I've kind of dived into the Dick Acts enough so that everybody can see. Folks, if you go through there and you look at what they're doing, they are literally stepping on these things within the Constitution. To do that, it would require an amendment. Now, when we get into the subsection 16, this is where the Congress will have these very specific powers to self-legislate themselves, and this is called the exclusive legislation. But the one part of this, see, everybody was really concerned with this exclusive legislation, and it opened the door of this concept of creating a state out of the District of Columbia, which is, they're still trying to do this. They've gotten very close. They've assumed things that they have no authority to do. The Congress has abdicated their responsibility, so we'll dive into this. But when we look at the last part of this, this actually identifies the purposes for federal government's possession of land. In other words, these are the lands you can possess to do what you need to do. In other words, this becomes federal land. And we'll dive into exactly how that happens. But when we get to the territory part of Article 4, that is not federal land, a permanent federal land for them to hold. They don't have any authority to go buy land and to make it theirs because they want to have this huge park. The only reason they can possess land is for the stipulated purposes right here identified or enumerated in subsection 16. So let's go through the very first part of exercising exclusive legislation for the seat of government, which is basically the first three sentences before you get to the new red part.
Congress shall have power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as made by concession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States.
That right there is literally speaking very specifically of establishing the seat of government of the United States, the District of Columbia. That's why they call it a district, and it cannot exceed 10 miles square. Now, why did they go with 10 miles square? Because they really didn't know, right? I mean, they didn't know what, you know, what the land would be like, usability of the land, and so forth. So they just wanted to make sure they had enough, but they didn't want to give them too much to where they could become property rich. Because when you go through the ratification base, they do talk about the fact of the people who actually own property, you know, are the ones that possess power. And so, because it's wealth, you know, it's kind of like anybody that teaches you to, you know, spend and always be in debt means that they're teaching you to be powerless. True power comes when you have purchasing power. In other words, you have a reserve of money that you can tap and you can just go, I'm going to spend this money on this. That means that you have the ability to make those decisions yourself. If you're dependent and you have to use a credit card, or if you're dependent on government, you have to wait till government either pays you or you know, your credit limit gets extended so that you can spend more money. That's what we would call a spendthrift. But the fact is, my family, my mother and grandmothers and so forth, it was taught, you know, generationally, you know, that a person that saves money and possesses their own savings has more power than a person that doesn't. The power of having your own resources, you know, cannot be marginalized. I mean, it is just like learning, you know, how to work and work for an honest wage, or, you know, put out the honest labor for an honest wage. Anyway, real critical things that we just don't teach kids anymore. But getting into the next part of this, see, this is all speaking to the seat of government. In other words, Congress shall have the exclusive legislation in what cases? Is it just for working with foreigners? Or is it, you know, for, you know, dealing with the different states or the neighboring states one way and in, you know, different states maybe not so much? It actually says right there, all cases, right?
All cases whatsoever.
That's right. So in other words, for policing the streets, for maintaining law and order, anything and everything, Congress has the responsibility to exercise their legislative authority. In other words, this is something that cannot be abrogated. They cannot just say, we're not going to do this. We're going to create this puppet government, and we're going to make them the bad guys, and this is what we're going to do. Because they can be bad guys by not actually enforcing the law, right?
As we well see nowadays.
There you go. So what they did by creating the city of the District of Columbia, putting a governor in there and a council, this is what they did in 1871 with the Organic Act, was a direct violation of this. For them to actually subjugate or actually abjugate their responsibility, give away this power, they needed to do it by amending that line, that Congress will no longer enjoy exclusive legislation, that will be left to the citizens of the District of Columbia to choose their governor and to choose this and this and this and this. Had they done that, then they would have been able to kind of go down that path. But here's the problem. In the ratification debates, it was clearly stated that the district or the seat of government was not to become a state or become its own government. They didn't want Congress or the federal government, we're going into a break here, but they didn't want the federal government to be a subject to and or, you know, dependent upon a other government, so that government, because they actually go through in the ratification debates of how Continental Congress was harassed in Pennsylvania, and so how they had to abandon their position, and it was a huge embarrassment to the nation. Anyway, when we come back, we'll dive more into this exclusive legislation regarding the enumerations of property. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so when we look at the other properties, these properties are delegated to them because they were deemed necessary for the government to possess this type of property to function. So they wanted to make sure that if government needed it, they were to ensure that they were going to get it by enumerating those things that were needed for them to function. So, in other words, the Constitution kind of dealt with all of the needs that they could even imagine the government would need. So, case in point, and yeah, I know you weren't on the show earlier, but we're going to cover this early next year when we dive into the Articles of Confederation. And Sean, when you read these things, we're actually going to read the amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And those amendments actually deal with things that do not allow Continental Congress to go out and buy paper and administrative supplies. So the Constitution actually gave them the ability to make law that would be necessary and proper for them to carry those things out. So why didn't they grant the federal government the ability to just say, whatever land you need, just, you know, just call it forth? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So they wanted to make sure that the federal government couldn't just make up, oh, well, we need to have parks. This is a good thing we need to have. It's a benefit for everybody to enjoy the land, and so we're going to start creating parks. They knew that if the federal government had the ability to just come up with, oh, we need to create a conservation and preserve the wetlands, or we need to, you know, preserve the spotted owl, because all humanity will be lost if the spotted owl goes extinct. Whatever they come up with in their justifications, if they had an open or basically the general powers of possessing property, then they could do whatever they wanted. But instead, what they did right here, these are all the enumerations of power and things that they possess. And right here, they're going to identify what they have the ability to possess when it comes to property that is permanently theirs. They got to pay for it, though, but we'll get into that. So go ahead. Starting off with to exercise like authority.
Right.
Okay.
To exercise, the Congress shall have power to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings.
Okay, so first off, they say that they can actually exercise the like authority, in other words, exercise this exclusive legislation over the following properties as long as it has been authorized by the state and paid for by the federal government, right? Is that not what it kind of says there?
What it says.
Okay. So when they started creating territories, and in the process of creating territories, the federal government needed to create magazines and arsenals and forts and so forth so that they could protect the people. And they continued this moving west. Every time the state would become a state, would Congress or the federal government be able to keep those forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings?
You would think they would have to compensate the states for it.
There you go. They'd have to go to the states and say, we think you need us. And so here connects the dot. If the state is not truly prepared to protect itself with its own militia, then the federal government is going to basically, if you kind of hurry in and say, you know what, don't worry about it. We're going to maintain these forts and we're going to, you know, take care of the Indians and your threats. We're going to keep you safe. Oh, boy, the federal government is so good. They were so nice. And actually, right. That was very deceitful. And bottom line, if we're a self-governing system, what they did was they, one, violated the Constitution, and two, they basically enabled themselves to assume more and more authority over these states, which is why when you read the Enabling Acts, there's no discussion over the forts and properties that they wanted to keep. Like in Ohio, when Ohio was brought in, and actually, I believe Ohio actually had a militia. It was pretty well populated when it was brought in. This is why it was kind of brought in early. And why was that? Because guess what? The majority of those people who were given land grants, they were the veterans of the Revolutionary War, they were giving them land grants in Ohio, which in doing that, you know, they were able to increase the population. And actually, they had a pretty much, you know, not a trigger happy, but they had, you know, a pretty good, I'll just say, expertise within their population of defending themselves, right? It's because, you know, you had a bunch of veterans in there. Now, here's an interesting thing. An interesting little fact. I found out that if you look, there's an area called the Redoubt area. R-E-D-O-U-B-T. Nobody's ever heard of this. There was a gentleman, I think it was in 2011, that wrote a book called The Redoubt Area. The Redoubt Area is the area of, you know, the land area between the Cascade Mountains and just west, or just east of the Rockies, going from Canada down into Northern California, Utah, maybe New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana. That area. That's the Redoubt area. And when I moved into the Redoubt area in 2015, I didn't realize this until, I want to say probably 2018, because I met a veteran who had was very dependent on a service dog because he would have seizures and so forth. And I thought it was absolutely great. And he pointed out that there is a higher population of veterans in this area than any other area in the United States because they didn't want to be around a bunch of people and they wanted to have land. So, and I think most people, when you actually read about the Redoubt book, it talks about preppers. It talks about people not trusting government, you know, because they've seen families get killed, the Ruby Ridge and so Waco, so forth, where they've just, you know, innocent people. And the fact of the matter is that when you look at a concentration of veterans, you're actually looking at, and wasn't there a movie, Patrick Swayze was in it. I forget what it was called. You might remember it.
Next of Kin.
Well, no. This was like when the Russians invaded.
Oh, Red Dawn.
Red Dawn. Okay,
yeah,
so
it's a documentary.
Yeah. So that was actually based on a study that recognized that if Russia invaded America, or if China invaded America, any, you know, occupying force tried to invade America, that the place that they would have the hardest place to occupy and to control would be the Redoubt area as one large mass. And I think when you get over to the Appalachians, there's some areas there too. It's much smaller. I mean, when you look at the mass from Washington State all the way down to, you know, Northern California and into those states that, you know, go through the Rockies where they have the plains there. So the point is this, is that there have been a high attraction because everybody, you know, realized the credibility of the study, that that's a safe haven if you want to keep from being controlled by government. That makes sense, right?
Absolutely. Okay. That's like some areas we have around my house.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, every state has those, but when it comes down to, you know, using land masking and the mountains and access in and so forth, the harder it is to access, the safer you are. It's kind of like your computer is safest when it's not connected on the network. Once you connect it on the network, the network has access to it, and access means that they're just going to be knocking your door down and coming in because they can, or they will try, what have you. But back to this subsection 16. We are seeing literally the fact that when the states became states, they just allowed the federal government without being compensated and without standing up and saying, hold on here, we really need to do this for ourselves. And I believe that this was when judges, because we talked about this as well, when the expanse of America was occurring, how many people do you think moved into Indiana because they wanted to become the first governor of Indiana? Well, I mean, you start moving out there. Most people didn't even see when or could even predict when Indiana would be crossing that line to become a state. Most people went out there because they wanted the chance to, you know, have a farm, have their family, have their business, and be able to just, you know, enjoy the freedom of America and live. That was the majority. I mean, if you look at all of the cases that drove people west, the gold, right? Oh, I'm going to go get gold, or I want to be a trapper. Whatever it was that you wanted to live off the land, use the resources of the land, that was the majority of all the people going out there. Very few people were actually moving out there because they wanted to be, and we talked about judges. I want to be a judge out there. And so we even talked about, you know, the cream of the crop judges didn't want to be put out there. They were getting the cream of the crop jobs. So those who were available were selected and are convinced to move out there. And in so doing, this created this class of people that were kind of, I'll just say, incentivized to make a journey and, you know, and plant their, you know, their feet, their roots in a given state to, you know, have this prominence above other people where the area you're coming from, there's no way you'd have that prominence. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we see these opportunities and the quality, you know, I can't say that there weren't good quality people moving into these states of leading and so forth, but I would say that the likelihood of them being the cream of the crop is probably really, really low. And so this is why when we started looking at the states and or these territories turning into states, and we look at how they created their constitutions and they did what the government told them, not realizing the government had no authority, the federal government had no authority to tell them how to make their government, what they needed to put in that constitution. When you read the First Enabling Acts, the federal government says you're going to become admitted, you go create your government, go create your constitution, and yea, verily, you will become the state of Ohio, the state of Florida, what have you. And that all changed because they said, oh, well, we want you to, you know, give us land. And they started creating the Ponzi scheme of land by 1820. By 1820, they actually created the Land Use Act or something like that. We already covered this, and we're going to cover it again next year. The point is, folks, is that the federal government realized the ability to start manipulating the situation and giving them a better outcome, where they were getting revenue that they shouldn't have been getting. They were selling property within states, sovereign states, and making proceeds. And the majority of the proceeds off of that property being sold was being piped into D.C. to make D.C. this nice community with a good education system. And so you can tell that they were favoring themselves over the states. And we'll actually get in here in Article 1, Section 9, where the federal government is denied to be able to set preferences for themselves or anyone. Anyway, so the point is this, is if it's not a fort, magazine, arsenal, dockyard, and or needful building, or let's just kind of summarize, I can think we could just say, if it's not for a legitimate military purpose for security, national security, or a needful building that supports the functions of the federal government, such as an inspection station at the airport to make sure all things, the commerce coming into the airport is, you know, acceptable, allowed, and meets their regulations and so forth. And that's it. No BLM land, no territories, or I should say, no reservations of forests, no reservations for, you know, different demographics of people, like Indian reservations. Nothing, because if it's not enumerated right here, then they can't possess it within a state. And if they do possess it, they have to pay for that. That's exactly what it says. And so this is very simple. The Constitution says what it says. And when people look at this, they go, how did they get to this point of being able to say, we're going to do this for you, we're going to do that for you? Because they convinced us that they can do anything, when the reality or the truth is they can't. Their powers are very specified. So what do we do? Because I want to just cover this, because I want to cover this several times as we go through these violations, because everything we've read so far in Article 1, Section 8, almost all of it are violations. So what do we do? How do we address this? We have to get our counties, to get our states to interpose. In other words, the states basically have to do what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison set out to do in 1798. And that's why we have those five critical documents, and we actually have the reading, and actually, Sean, you were a member of the group reading that. So, folks, if you go listen to those 14 audio sets of reading through these five critical documents, you'll actually hear Sean. And so, I don't know, you might hear me there, but anyway, the point is that these men that created or were inspired by the divine hand of providence to do these very specific things were so wise. I mean, what a blessing it is to basically say, hey, government, these are the only things you can have. You can't do anything else. The real problem is they've been able to assume all of these different powers. The real problem they have is how can they exercise a war, literally shooting and killing wholesale. I mean, they can get away with, you know, taking out one family up in the Idaho Mountains, the Ruby Ridge issue. You know, they can take out Lavoie Finicum out in Oregon. They can take, you know, a person here, a person there. But when the government deploys the Army, the Marines, and everybody else to start killing the people of these different states who are actually saying, you don't have the authority to do these things, I don't think they'll get away with it. I'm convinced that they can't. Because the American people have actually been coaxed into joining wars because people were being bullied and manhandled by these, you know, these tyrants around the world. And we should never have been involved in those wars. But we decided as a people we were going to get involved because Hitler had no business doing what he was doing to all these good people. Right?
Right.
Okay. So,
and now they're doing it to us.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're none the wiser, right? I say that sarcastically.
I think that's part of, they trained us by saying, oh, we have to go around and stop these bullies. And now, yes, they're making out our government to be the bully that we're supposed to stop at the moment.
And I think that that's one of the reasons why people are exposing plans and ideas that it won't be the U.S. forces that will actually wage warfare in America. It will be international forces that will do it. The question is, what will the American forces, those people wearing the uniform, are they going to just stand idly by and let the government tie their hands while they watch us being killed, us being basically, you know, taken out, so that they can, you know, implement their new world order, their new plan? So anyway, final subsection of 8. This is the necessary and proper clause, 17.
The Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof.
Okay, so this is what they called the sweeping clause. And when they went through this, they said right there, this gives them the ability to do anything necessary and proper that they think they need to do. This is where Hamilton hooked his little hook of implied powers and said, this is where we can use this to pull off implied powers like creating a bank. Now, actually, when you look at the highlighted text or the highlighted words in yellow, it literally says, now when you read this from the very beginning to the end of that yellow text, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Is there any comma in that clause that I just read? Is there a semicolon? Is there a break at all to separate and isolate to say those, that yellow text is not directly associated to those previous words?
No, sir.
That's right. And I don't know, I'm not one to lecture anybody regarding grammar. You know, I write books, and I know I should have probably paid more attention to that. But I am here to tell you folks that for the execution, for carrying into execution, the foregoing powers is very specific and tied, giving them the ability to make all laws necessary and proper. In other words, the way they actually described this in several of the ratification debates was, what would it have been? Would it have changed the meaning of this had they, at the end of each power, let's just go up to subsection 1, to borrow money on the credit of the United States and to make all laws necessary and necessary and proper to execute this power. And then at the next one, to regulate commerce, blah, 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 with Indian tribes, and make all laws necessary and proper to execute these powers. In other words, had they put that at the end of each line, they wouldn't have had to say the foregoing powers. But instead of being repetitive and maintaining that same language for every power being delegated, they just made it at the very bottom inclusive that the foregoing powers, Congress shall have the ability to make laws necessary and proper for the execution of the foregoing powers, period. Right? Does that help? Because they actually say that in the ratification debates, that this is literally pointing to the execution of the foregoing powers, not to assume any new power. And it was constantly being, moved by dramatics and hyperbole of the anti-federals. Oh, they can do anything there. No. And this is the reality. As the Constitution was being stipulated, as the Constitution was being elucidated, as it was being clarified, as they were going through and explaining each of these lines and what they meant, the anti-federalists were basically saying they're going to, we signed this, as soon as we walk out those doors, we're going to be dead. They were using fear tactics. I mean, who uses those types of tactics? Look today, and, you know, those people who are trying to influence the direction and decisions of government using fear mongering and tactics and so forth, demagoguery, who is it that does that?
The Democrats.
The Democrats. And yet, we see conservative organizations using fear-mongering and those types of tactics. I'll give
what was the big one they had recently? It's going to be the end of democracy.
Yeah.
He's a threat to democracy.
Yeah, so, but I see conservatives doing the exact same thing.
And absolutely.
And as a matter of fact, the John Birch Society, the Convention of States, basically point at each other and say, you know, they're the doom. And, you know, and they use this fear-mongering, oh, it's going to be a runaway convention. Or, oh, you know, what do they say? I forget what they say about it. Because the John Birchers literally are making things up. They're lying. They're being disingenuous. But it's the same thing. Both sides are lying and using demagoguery. Instead of actually saying, hey, we got a problem. We all agree we have a problem. What are we going to do about it? Why is it? Because I actually presented Republic Review. I actually went to them before I actually started talking about how to execute this, because it was with the National Liberty Alliance in 2019 with John... who's the leader of John Durash of the National Liberty Alliance. I started working with him in identifying what has to happen down in the counties. What does it take to make a constitutional county? In other words, what's our exit criteria? You have to have these kind of conversations to come up with, you know, what is our end? What are we, you know, trying to attain? And so I started doing that with them. But I went to the John Birch Society. They didn't want to have anything to do with the solution. They only cared about keeping everybody at bay and maintaining their membership so that they could, you know, let everybody feel good that they're in charge. Because they're the organization. They've been selling this for a long time. They're the organization that has been stopping the growth of communism in America since the 1950s. Now, folks, when you actually give somebody a grade for the production or their, you know, give them a grade for, you know, the product of their work, do they deserve an A in stopping the growth of communism since the 1950s? I'll ask you, Absolutely. Sean, do you think they deserve an A?
No.
What about a B?
No, I think they deserve an F because, first of all, I've heard of the John Birch Society, but I could not tell you in any certain terms what it is they're promoting or how they go about doing it or anything like that. And I agree with you that there's a lot of these organizations that their only purpose and mission is the ongoing perpetual existence of their organization and the people who run it. You know, they're not actually trying to affect constitutional compliance. They're just trying to keep their, like you said, subscriptions and memberships.
Right. In other words, maintaining self-relevance. Yeah, what they're doing is maintaining self-relevance and maintaining their own revenue, because the problem is their goose that lays the golden egg. You solve the problem, that golden egg goes away.
Exactly.
We don't need them anymore. And it's the same thing with all of these organizations. And that's a sad thing. So with that, thank you so much for your contributions, as always, Sean. We're going to dive into Article 1, Section 9 in our next episode. So you're going to want to hear this, because these are the hard restrictions placed upon the federal government. And then we'll go into the hard restrictions placed upon the states in Section 10. I'm Jerry Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.